Everyone, welcome to the Live Through Jesus podcast with Courtney Gilmore. On this episode, being on the side of justice. This is 1 Samuel 19:11 to 20:42. Have you ever been in a situation where two people that you know are having a dispute and you love both of them, but one of them is wrong and one of them is right? Like, clearly, you know that this one person is the one that has caused all of the problems. And then you're in a situation, it's like, what do I do about this? I really don't want to take sides. But then at some point, you are forced to. You have no option because these two people have involved you in their problem, and you have to take a side. This is like the worst situation to be in because you love both of these people. You don't want to be involved. You wish you could just stay out of all of it, but now you're being forced to take a side, and you know that if you take any one side, that the other person is going to be upset. And maybe one of the people is closer family member to you. Maybe they are a family member and the other person is just someone that you know. I've been in a situation like that where it's like my actual blood family is the one that's wrong and they're married to somebody that's not my blood, but I know them. I've known them my whole life and I love that person too. But if I go against my blood relative, then they're going to be really upset with me and the other person may not even be around if I could just let it go. But it's hard to do that because you know that that other person is innocent. And then on the flip side, you know that the person that is your blood relative is the person that's wrong. And so you're caught between justice and, you know, family ties. And that's the situation that both of Saul's children find themselves in because Saul is wrong and David is right. And they both love David. Jonathan is his best friend and Michal is his wife. And so they both love David. They both love their dad, but their dad is, you know, their dad, their blood relative, but he's the one that's wrong. And so they're put in a predicament of do we choose the side of justice or do we choose our dad? And in our lesson today, we're going to find out that they both choose the side of justice, which is what we should choose, but it is difficult. And so we're going to go through this story and then we're going to talk as we go along about how we can find the courage to, you know, stand on the side of justice instead of maybe on the side of our family member. And so in our last lesson, we just did the first 11 verses of chapter 19, and we found out that Saul wanted to kill David, but Jonathan talked him out of it. And then he sent David back to war, and David got more and more accolades. And so Saul was done with it, right? He's like, I can't take it anymore. And so the distressing spirit from the Lord comes over him, and he gets David to come and play the harp for him like he always does. But this time, his music is not making him happy, and he impulsively throws a spear at David like he had done previously, whenever he was jealous of him. But the last time that he did it in an impulsive rage, he let David go and he never went back after him because he, you know, knew that he shouldn't do it. But this time he's already premeditated his murder. He's past impulsivity. And so even though this is an impulsive act, he's already premeditated it in his mind. And so now when he does the impulsive thing, he's like, yeah, I'm done. I'm not letting him go this time. And so David runs away and, you know, is free and he gets to his house. But then Saul sends messengers to David's house to kill him. And Michal, his wife, she knows that her dad's serious this time. And so she helps David escape through the window. And then after he escapes, she gets something that apparently resembles a doll, something sort of like a doll, and she puts it under the covers of their bed, and then she puts goat's hair on its head so that it will look like David. And when the messengers come to the door, she says, I'm sorry, David is sick in bed. And so the messengers go back to Saul and they say, I'm sorry, David is sick in bed. And he says, yeah, I don't care. Bring him to me in the bed if you have to, but I'm killing him. I want him here now. And so the messengers go back to get David and realize David's not there, that he has escaped. And when they go back and tell Saul, Saul realizes that his daughter helped David escape. And so he addresses that and says, you know, why in the world would you choose him over me? And she could have done what her brother did and say, you know, he's innocent and I love him and it's the wrong thing to do. But this time her dad is actively trying to carry this out. Whenever he was talking to Jonathan, he was just talking about it. And so she knows what her dad's capable of. And she thinks it would be better for me to just say, to just blame it all on David because he already wants to kill David. And so she just says to him, David forced me. I didn't have another option. And this is a good time for us to discuss the fact that, you know, the author is just telling this story. He is not editorializing. He's not saying, you know, this is right or wrong, what his wife did. He's just giving us the details of the story. And so sometimes the Bible is not prescriptive, it's just descriptive. So it's just telling us the story and not telling us, you know, this is what you should do. It's not prescribing this to us. And so we don't need to get hung up on the fact that, you know, whether Michal had done something right or wrong. We don't, you know, she carried this out perfectly. This isn't saying that we can justify lying just to save our own skin. It's just saying that that's what she decided to do at this time. And so the point of the story is what he's trying to get across. And so he doesn't detour to say, and by the way, she shouldn't have really done that. What she really should have done is this. It's like, that's not the point. The point is she stood on the side of justice and David escaped. And so that's what we need to get out of this, not get hung up on the rest of it. And so then it goes on, the story goes on to tell us that David escaped and went to Samuel, which remember is the one who anointed him as king, but he also anointed Saul as king. And so he must be very sad to find out that Saul is trying to kill David. And you know, we know already that he was sad in the first place that God had rejected Saul as king, even though Saul had disobeyed God a bunch of times, because he loved Saul and he wanted him to have done the right thing and for God to continue to, you know, allow him to be the king. But God had rejected him and Samuel liked David. It says that the right away, as soon as he met David, he was attracted to him. And so he loved David. And actually, Saul had loved David too. So this is such a sad scenario, because the first time that he met David, he was meeting him as the boy that was coming to play the harp for him and make him feel better. And then the next time that he had an encounter with David was when David saved the whole kingdom by fighting Goliath. And this looked good on Saul. And so Saul had always liked David, but when David got more accolades than Saul did, then he began getting jealous. And so Samuel must have been very sad about this, but he also believed David. He knew that Saul was trying to do this because he said, we really need to go escape to the place where all of the prophets are. And so they went and surrounded themselves with God's people so that maybe, you know, Saul wouldn't attack them in that space. It would be like us fleeing to the church, hoping that nobody is going to go and kill us there in the church. And so that's what Samuel did. But Saul had sent messengers to kill David, and when they found him there in the presence of Samuel and all of the prophets, it says that the Spirit of the Lord overcame them, and they began prophesying themselves. And so they didn't kill David as they had been commanded. And then so Saul sent another set of messengers, and the same thing happened to them. And so after three times of this, finally Saul decides to go find David himself. And when he approaches Samuel and the prophets, sees that, you know, he's in the presence of the man that had anointed him the king in the first place, he also begins prophesying. And so the power of the Lord is so strong in this place that even though they have the intent of doing something bad, the Spirit of the Lord overcomes them just because they're in the place where the Spirit of the Lord is, and they can't carry out their evil deed. And then it says that because Saul was in the presence of the Lord and in the presence of Samuel, it says that he stripped off his clothes and he also prophesied before Samuel day and night. And some people believe that it means he was totally naked. Maybe he was, but All the commentators seem to agree that at least he was taking off all of his outer garments. And that would make him naked in a sense. It would make him wear, you know, he's in indecent clothes, but he's being vulnerable. And he's also taking off his royal clothing. That would be all of his outer clothing. And the point would be to show his vulnerability and his humility, realizing that he is not the king right now. You know, he is just a man who is a sinner. And so it's showing that by, he's showing that by, you know, what he's doing here. And then that passage ends by saying that because Saul began to also prophesy, that people said exactly what they said about him when he got anointed and was in the presence of the prophets. Is Saul also a prophet? This became a saying. And they say that this was the last time that we see the Spirit of the Lord come over Saul. And you know, the Spirit of the Lord came over Saul in the beginning when he was anointed and he prophesied in the presence of the prophets. And now it is happening again to him when he is in the presence of God in the presence of the prophets. And so it's marking the beginning and the end of God's time with him as the king, showing that he is prophesying these the first time and at the end of when God is recognizing him as the king. Even though he has, you know, does remain the king for a little bit longer, God is not going to show his presence with Saul ever again. And he's, you know, showing that he's totally rejected him as the king. And something that I just thought was so beautiful is how when the presence of God is in a certain place, it's like the people were just totally overcome. They couldn't even carry out their evil plans because God's presence was so incredibly strong. And so I wanted to read you two verses. Matthew 18:20 says, "For where two or more are gathered together in my name, I am in the midst of them." So we know that God's presence can be with us when it's just us, for sure. And that happens all the time when we are just by ourselves, praying, worshiping, reading his word. He is with us. But he promises that when there are two or more gathered in his name, that he is there. And so what a wonderful thing for us to see. And this is what all of us should do. When we realize our sin, we should immediately go to God, be in his presence, rather through, you know, reading of the word, prayer, worship, or going to church. We should get in his presence and stay there. If Saul would have stayed in the presence of the Lord, either in body as he is at this moment, or at least in spirit when he left the actual place, if he could have remained in spirit with God, praying, worshiping, you know, reading his word, then he probably never would have sinned, because when he was in the presence of the Lord, he couldn't sin. It's like he was so overcome with God's presence that he couldn't even carry out the evil thing that he wanted to do. And so that would have happened if he would have remained in God's presence. But as soon as he left the physical presence of God, he did not remain spiritually in God's presence. And so the feelings just came right back. And so in Hebrews 10:23-25, it says that all of us need to hold fast to the confession of our hope without wavering. For he who promised is faithful. We need to hold fast to the confession of our hope without wavering, because God is faithful. And we need to consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, and not neglect meeting together, as is the habit of some. But we need to encourage one another, and all the more as we see the day of God approaching. We need to fellowship. When Saul was in the presence of all of these believers, he was vulnerable and convicted and repentant. And so being in God's, you know, sometimes we may try to worship at home or read his Bible or pray, but we may not be able to do it. We still may be so overcome. And so we need to get more, you know, than what we can just get by ourselves. And so we go to church, we surround ourselves with other people, or we just call another believer on the phone, you know, whatever it is, but gather more people who also believe in God so that, you know, you can overcome your evil desires. And so right here, that's what it's saying, is that if we will go to church, we'll be surrounded with other people who can lift us up, who can encourage us to love and do the right thing. And so if Saul would have done that, if he would have remained in the presence of these people, or if he would have remained in the Spirit of God, then he would have been able to do this, but he didn't remain there. And so he, you know, ended up, we're going to find out in a minute, falling to temptation. And so I want us each to think before we move on to chapter 20, have you ever been in this situation before? Have you ever gone to church or been in prayer or been in worship and felt like God told you to do something? But then literally the second you walk out the doors of the church, or you get up off your knees, or you stop saying the words, or you stop singing the song, or whatever it is, it's like you never remember it. It just completely slips your mind. It's like Satan just comes and snatches those thoughts right away. You know, he talks about that whenever it says that the word of God is like a seed planted in the ground. And if the seed falls on the good soil and it takes root, then you've got a good chance. But if the seed falls on rocky ground and the bird comes and takes it away, it's just like Satan. It's like we don't let it take root. And so what ends up happening is it just gets snatched away. Satan snatches that thought right out of our heads if we don't do something to, you know, really plant it. So we have that thought in our minds while we're in church or prayer or worship or whatever. But then because we don't continue to think about it and then follow through pretty quickly on it, then Satan just comes and snatches it away. And that is what happened here. In James 1:22-25, it says, "Be doers of the word and not just hearers, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man who observes his natural face in the mirror. But after he observes himself, he goes away and he immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it and isn't a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, he is the one who will be blessed in what he does." And so, don't be like the person who looks in the mirror and then forgets what kind of man he is, forgets what God has compelled him to do. Be the person that doesn't just hear what God says, but actually does it. If we will do that, then we won't be like Saul and go away and just immediately forget all of our convictions. And so that is how chapter 19 leaves off. And then when we begin in chapter 20, it tells us that while Saul was there in the presence of God and the prophets and Samuel, David ran back to Jonathan to let him know everything that was going on. But Jonathan is like, "No, I talked to Dad. He said he wanted to kill you, but then I talked to him and he promised me that he wouldn't. And so I think you must be mistaken." And David's like, "Hey, I'm not mistaken. He tried to throw a spear at me. And then whenever I ran away, he sent messengers to kill me. And then after I ran to Samuel, then he sent more messengers to kill me. And he even came out to kill me himself. And the only thing that stopped him was the presence of God. I'm telling you, I know what's going on. He's trying to kill me." And Jonathan's like, I need to get to the bottom of this. He's like, "Here's the deal. I know that the new moon, the feast of the new moon is coming up soon. And Saul is going to expect David at his table for the feast of the new moon, which is the feast that they have at the first of every month when the new moon comes up to, you know, mark the beginning of this month." And so he's like, "I know that he's going to want you there." And so Jonathan says, "Here's what you need to do. You go and hide in the field and I will go to the dinner like I normally would. And when Dad asks about you and asks where you are, I'll tell him that your family has requested that you come and make sacrifices with them. And then that I gave you permission." And then if I tell him this and he is like, oh yeah, I'm glad you gave him permission to do that. I'm sure that his family wants him there. Then we'll know that he's not upset with you anymore. It was an impulsive reaction. He went and was in the presence of God and the prophets and Samuel, and he's changed his mind. But if when I tell him that you have gone to be with your family, he says, why did you give him permission, Jonathan? And he's mad at me, then we'll know that he's still trying to kill you. And then I will come out into this same field that you are hiding in with my bow and my arrows and a boy to retrieve the arrows. And then I'll give you this signal to let you know whether he is trying to kill you or not. What I'm going to do is I will shoot the arrows and then tell the boy to go fetch them. And if dad is not mad anymore, I'm going to say, hey, isn't the arrow near? Come this direction and then you'll see it. And that will let you know that you can come this direction. You know, the boy thinks that I'm talking to him, but it's really code to you to say, hey, you can come near Saul and he's not going to kill you. But if I tell the boy, hey, I shot the arrow beyond you, go further, then you will know that I'm sending you far away from my dad because my dad's trying to kill you. And David says, well, what if your dad won't let you come back and warn me? Like, what if he's so mad at you that he detains you? And Jonathan's like, I promise you that I will find a way to warn you. I love you. You're innocent. I will definitely find a way to warn you. And you know what? If I don't warn you, then may the curse be on me. May God kill me himself, you know, if I don't do this. Like, I'm taking this very seriously, like on my life. I will come and warn you. And then he even goes as far to say, I pray that God will give you vengeance on those who are seeking to hurt you, on all of your enemies, knowing that that means his dad, that he wants David to get vengeance from on his dad because he knows who is right and who is wrong. But then he asks David, he says, since I am protecting you and since I'm asking for vengeance for you, will you do me a favor also? If God gives you this vengeance and he takes the throne from my family and he gives the throne to you instead, then spare my life and spare the life of my descendants. Will you do that since I've done these things for you? And David's like, of course, you know. And so the two boys make a covenant, each of them making a promise to protect each other and be loyal to each other. And then they part and David goes to hide and Jonathan goes back home. And then Jonathan goes to the feast the next day. Well, Saul doesn't even ask about David at all. So Jonathan doesn't have a chance to give him an answer, you know, to find out anything at all. Saul doesn't ask about him because he just assumes David didn't show up because he's unclean. You can't participate in a sacrificial ceremony if you have become unclean for any reason. And he's like, something must have happened. He must have come in contact with a dead body or something. And, you know, he can't come to the feast. No big deal. But then the next day, when David still doesn't show up, Saul's like, what in the world's going on? And so he asked Jonathan, and Jonathan tells him, you know, hey, his brother's head of the house now, and he's requested that he come and make us the sacrifices with the whole family, and I gave him permission. And Saul is furious. It says that Saul is, you know, griping at Jonathan and saying, why in the world did you ever do this? And then he even says, do you not understand that he's, you know, a threat to you, to the kingdom that you're going to inherit? Like, you're not going to be the king because he is, you know, a threat to your ability to become king. And Jonathan's like, yeah, it's not a reason to kill somebody, Dad. Like, you can't kill someone to have power or, you know, remain in power. That's not okay. He hasn't done anything wrong. And this enrages Saul against his own son. And it says he throws something at him too, like his spear across the room towards him. And he also says, you know, you've brought shame on this entire family, you know, by choosing David over your own father. I cannot believe you would do such a thing. And then he throws a spear across the room towards Jonathan, his son. And now it's Jonathan's turn to be enraged and ashamed. He's like, I am angry that you are reacting to me toward like this. And I am so ashamed that you would, you know, try to kill an innocent man just to stay in power because you're jealous. This is ridiculous. And it says that Jonathan got up from the table, didn't eat anything. And then the next day he went out into the field and did exactly what he told David he would do. He shot the arrows and told the boy, I'm going to read this to you. Verbatim, he says in verse 37, is not the arrow beyond you? Hurry, be quick, do not stay. So that's what he tells the boy, but this lets David know that he needs to run far away quickly. You do not even stay here. Get away now. Dad is furious. And so this should have been the end of it, right? He gave him his little code word and he should have just gone back home, but Jonathan can't do it. He wants to say goodbye to his friend. He doesn't know if he's ever going to see him again. And so he sends the boy back with his arrows to the city, and then he goes to seek out David. And whenever it's safe, David comes out from his hiding place, and it says that he bowed down to Jonathan three times. This would show his reverence to Jonathan as the royal son. So he is acknowledging his, royalty there. And then it says that the two embraced and they hugged and they cried. And then it says something interesting. It says, but David cried more. And so it's like both of them are losing the friendship, but David is sadder because his whole life was going to be different now. And he hasn't even done anything wrong. And so then it ends by saying that Jonathan tells David to go in peace. And he says, may the Lord be with you and between your offspring forever. And then the two of them go their separate ways. David runs away. Jonathan goes back home. And so both of Saul's children took David's side and helped him escape. They stood on the side of justice at the risk of alienating their own father and possibly risk of their own safety, right? And they didn't take David's side because they loved him more. You know, that's what people will always accuse you of. It's like, oh, you take his side because you like him better. It's like, no, it's because he's right. I love you both, but he's the one that's right and you are the one that's wrong. And that's just the fact of the matter. And so I'm taking the side of justice. I'm not taking the side of, you know, this person specifically. The children were doing what their father couldn't, and they were rising above their emotions to do what was right. Proverbs 18:5 says, it is not good to be partial to the wicked or to deprive the righteous of justice. And so they couldn't be partial to their dad who was doing a wicked thing. And they couldn't deprive David of the justice that he deserved. And so they had to take his side against their own dad. And so has this ever happened to you? Have you ever been tempted to choose a loved one over what's right? Such a hard thing. It is such a hard thing. But God loves justice and righteousness, and we should love it too. And so what we have to realize is that we're not actually choosing one person over the other. When we choose righteousness and justice over the other person, then we're actually choosing God's way over the other person. And so we're choosing to align ourselves with the Lord. And so the real choice is not between these two people, but between God and this person. And when you put it that way, it makes it much easier, right, to choose God. Logically, if we can separate ourselves from the emotion, then we can choose God over the other person because we know that that is the right thing to do. Even Jesus says this in Matthew 12, 46 to 50. It says that while he was talking to the multitudes, his mother and his brothers stood outside seeking to speak with him. And then somebody came to him and they said, your mothers and your brothers are standing outside seeking to speak with you. He stretched out his hand towards the disciples and says, here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother. And so what he's trying to say is, I love my family, but you are my family too because you choose God. And that means you are my brothers and sisters in him. And all of us are his children. And so I choose God even over my own family. And so let this inspire you to stand on the side of justice, no matter the personal cost. Whenever you do, you are standing on God's side, and He's going to take care of you. Don't let your own fear or your love towards someone else allow you to be complicit in their sin. Don't let anyone shame you, make you feel like, you know, you're not being loving or you're not being kind, because you can't take their side just because they make you feel bad or because they might be angry with you. You have to trust God and stand strong. It's a sacrifice that we make for the one who sacrificed everything for us, right? If Jesus has sacrificed all for us, the least we can do is stand on His side. In Joshua 1, 7 through 9, it says, "Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from the right or the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you to be strong and of good courage? Don't be afraid, don't be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." So stand strong, trusting God. It does cost us something. It is a sacrifice to follow Him. But He made a sacrifice for us, so how could we not? Luke 14, 26 to 33 says, "If anyone comes to me and doesn't hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even his very own life, he can't be my disciple." And so He's not saying hate in the sense of "I can't stand you." It's like just hyperbole. You know, if you don't love me more than you love them, then you can't be my disciple. "And whoever does not bear his cross and come after me can't be his disciple." So bear his cross means sacrifice, die to self. Whoever is not willing to kill his own earthly desires for my sake cannot be my disciple. "For which of you, intending to build a tower, doesn't sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? Lest after he has laid the foundation and he isn't able to finish, all who see it will mock him and say, 'This man began to build, but he wasn't able to finish.' Or what king going to war against another king doesn't first sit down and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all he has can't be my disciple." So He's saying, if you were to go to war, you would count the cost. If you were to build a house, you would count the cost. Well, if you're going to follow me, you should count the cost. You should realize it's going to cost you something, and then really weigh whether you're willing to do that or not. But it's worth it. He is worth it. So stand on the side of justice. That's what we can learn from this story today. And that's all we have for today. Make sure that you subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. Also, if you would like this lesson in writing, you can go to livethroughjesus.substack.com. You can become a paid subscriber there for $6 a month or $60 a year. You can get these lessons written out. And not only this lesson, but also all of them that I have there on the website, beginning in Deuteronomy with the Ten Commandments, and then the rest of Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, Samuel, Saul, and now David. Get access to all of those. You just go to the tab, click on it, and then you can get the full study of whichever one you want to do. And then the ones as we're going will be emailed to you each week. And the great thing about digital study is if you're doing it by yourself, then you can click on all of the scriptures and they're all linked. And so they just all come up on your device, and then you can change it to whatever Bible version you want. And you don't have to flip through the Bible and find everything. And if you're doing it with a group, then you can just get one subscription and then print off all the materials, and everybody doesn't have to get their own study. So it's a cheap way to do a Bible study with other people. So please at least go to Substack and either become a free subscriber or a paid subscriber. If you become a free subscriber, then you will get an email sent to you each week that is just the application from what we've learned. So I do it in the form of a blog post, just something that we've learned from this lesson without the whole teaching. It's much shorter, and that will be emailed to you each week. And then I also teach that on a separate YouTube and podcast channel that is called Live Through Jesus Weekly Devotions. And so if you don't, you know, want to read it, you can go and subscribe to that other channel and you can listen to it. So lots of ways for you to join in the study of the Bible with me. And then last thing is go to the social media accounts that I have at Live Through Jesus, and you can watch clips from this and get scriptures from it and all of those things. And then I'll see you back next week. Thanks and have a good day. Mm-hmm.